Let me ask you a question I think a lot of men are afraid to ask themselves. If willpower was the problem, if the reason you kept going back to pornography was just a lack of discipline, a lack of commitment, a lack of faith, then why do men with iron willpower in every other area of their life still get wrecked by this thing? Men who run companies, lead churches, coach teams, raise great kids, honor their commitments in every public dimension of their life. I'll tell you why. Because willpower is not the right weapon for this fight. Not because men are weak, but because this is a neurological battle and you've been trying to fight it with a moral strategy. Welcome to the Purity Podcast, sponsored by Castamonia. I'm Chris Archinall, and today we're going somewhere I don't normally go in this podcast, the actual science of what pornography does to your brain, what triggers are and how to interrupt them, and then what to expect in the first 90 days of recovery. And then all of that about how it maps back to the transformational recovery matrix. Because when you understand what's happening inside you, you stop fighting yourself and you start cooperating with the God who's trying to heal you. Let's get into it. All right, one molecule, that's where we start, dopamine. Many of you have heard of that. Now, before your eyes glaze over, I'm not going to give you a biology lecture. I'm going to show you why this one chemical explains something that no amount of shame, accountability software, or good intentions has been able to explain. Why you go back. Dopamine is often described as the pleasure chemical, but that's not quite right. Dopamine is the wanting chemical. It fires not when you experience something good, but when you anticipate it. It's the neurological engine behind desire, pursuit, and motivation. In a healthy brain, it works beautifully. You're hungry, you see food, dopamine fires and drives you toward it. You feel connection, intimacy, accomplishment. Dopamine rewards the pursuit of genuinely good things. God designed the system, so it's not an enemy. Here's what pornography does to that system. Pornography delivers a supernormal stimulus, a level of dopamine activation that no natural experience can match. Researchers have documented dopamine spikes from pornography that parallel what the brain experiences with cocaine. That's not an analogy. It's a neurological measurement. And when you blast your reward system with that kind of intensity repeatedly, your brain does the only rational thing it can do. It adapts. It reduces the number of dopamine receptors. It downregulates. Because its job is to maintain balance. And if you keep hitting it with a fire hose, it starts closing valves. So, what does your life feel like when that happens? It feels flat, gray, ordinary pleasures stop working, food doesn't taste right, a real conversation doesn't achieve what you want, intimacy with your wife feels hollow, and then that shame compounds everything. A beautiful day, a moment with your kids, something that used to bring you joy, it doesn't even register. The clinical term is anhedonia. It's the inability to feel pleasure from life. And here is the trap that closes around men. When everything feels flat and gray and ordinary life has no voltage, your brain knows exactly one thing that still lights the board, and it reaches for it. Not because you're depraved, because you're wired. That's not an excuse. It's a diagnosis. And you need a correct diagnosis before you can pursue a correct treatment. Now, here's where I want to bring in the transformational recovery matrix, because this neurological reality maps directly to into two of the quadrants. The transactional quadrant is this high action, low awareness, doing the recovery behaviors, accountability, groups, software, check-ins, without ever dealing really with the interior wiring. The brain is still governed by the same pathways. The behavior is managed. The man is not transformed. In the transactional quadrant, men are often the men who've been in recovery for years and still relapse. They're not hypocrites. They're genuinely trying. But they're trying to solve a neurological and spiritual problem with a behavioral checklist. The brain never got rewired. The heart never got touched. Okay, the second quadrant, typically this is tied to, is the trivial quadrant. This is kind of that idea of living in denial. This is the, if you remember the quadrants, it's the lower left quadrant. It's low action, low awareness. This is where anhedonia becomes spiritually dangerous. When a man can no longer feel the weight of his sin, when the flatness has set in so completely that he's lost his conviction, he's not just struggling with addiction anymore. He's lost the internal signal that tells him something is wrong. The trivial quadrant doesn't always shout. Sometimes it's a faint whisper. A man goes through the motions of faith, of family, maybe even goes through the motions of recovery. I would say they're probably in the kind of upper right hand, you know, corner of the or right side of the trivial quadrant. But that's numbness. It's not peace. It's the fruit of a brain that has been overloaded for too long. But here's the word that changes everything in your recovery: neuroplasticity. The same brain that was rewired by addiction can be rewired back. That is not a motivational or self-help phrase. That is peer-reviewed science. The brain is a living, changing organ that reshapes itself based on experience, practice, and sustained input. Paul wrote in Romans 12:2, like we just talked about recently, "Be transformed by the renewing of your mind." He didn't have an fMRI, the functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, but he described 2,000 years ago exactly what neuroscience now confirms. Renewal is not a metaphor. It is biology, and it requires cooperation. The question isn't whether your brain can change. The question is what that change actually costs and whether you understand the process well enough to stay in it when it gets hard. Every man I've talked to in recovery eventually describes some version of the same moment. I don't know what happened. One minute I was fine. I had no intention of going there. And then I just was there. Like I blacked out between the thought and the behavior. That's not a character flaw. That's a trigger working exactly as triggers work. A trigger is a cue, internal or external, that activates a neural pathway so deeply grooved that the brain begins executing a behavior before the thinking mind catches up. The more times you've traveled that road, you've worn this path, the more automatic the trip becomes. You've essentially trained your brain to move from stimulus to behavior without a conscious decision point, which means the intervention has to happen before the trigger fires. You have to understand the road before you can close it. Triggers fall into like four broad categories. Now, I want to go through each one of those, and I want you to be honest with yourself as I go through these. First, emotional triggers. Stress is the most common here, but under stress, there's actually something more specific. It's usually like anxiety, loneliness, unexpressed anger, shame, rejection, feeling of being unseen or unwanted. Men who don't have healthy pathways to process emotion get rerouted. The unprocessed emotion becomes pressure, and the brain routes that pressure toward the thing that will relieve it the fastest. That's an emotional trigger. Second, situational triggers. Alone at a hotel, late at night when the house is quiet, a specific device, a specific app, even a specific type of content that isn't sexually explicit. But your brain has wired this like it's as an on-ramp. Maybe it's a physical location, a particular time of day. A routine that ends in a specific place. That's situational. Those are the situational triggers. Relational triggers are the third. A conflict with your wife, disconnection or feeling unwanted, rejected after initiating something, watching other couples and feeling a deficit in your own marriage, feeling invisible at work or at home. These triggers are relational wounds seeking a neurological painkiller. The fourth is physical triggers. Fatigue is wildly underrated. Sleep deprivation impairs the prefrontal cortex. That's the part of your brain responsible for judgment, impulse control, and long-term thinking. When you're exhausted, you are neurologically less equipped to resist. Same with hunger. Same, honestly, with certain types of prolonged stress. So The first discipline is not resistance, it's awareness. Here's your homework from today's episode. I want you to take a piece of paper, actual piece of paper, and write down your last three significant falls. Not to beat yourself up, but to investigate. For each one, I want you to ask, what time of day was it? What was I doing 2 hours before? What was I feeling? Was I alone? Was there a conflict in a relationship? Had I slept well? Had I eaten? What was the first thought or image that appeared, and what preceded it? You're looking for the pattern. I would kind of call this a ritual, because once you see the pattern or that ritual starting, you're no longer ambushed. You're informed, and informed men can make a plan. Now, what do you do when you've already identified a trigger and the craving has already landed? This is where I want to teach you something called urge surfing. And I want you to actually learn this, not just hear it, because it genuinely changes things when men apply it. The premise is this: a craving is not a command, it's a wave. Research on craving intensity shows that most urges, if you don't act on them and don't try to white knuckle them into submission, peak around 3 to 10 minutes, and then they subside. They always subside. No wave breaks the same shore forever. So the lie your brain tells you in that moment, and it will tell it convincingly, is this will not stop. The only way through it is to act out. But that's not true. It has never been true. You just haven't had a strategy for surviving that wave long enough to discover it. Here's what urge surfing looks like in practice. So the moment you recognize a craving, name it out loud if you can. I'm having a craving right now. That sounds like almost too simple, right? But naming the experience activates your prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, and begins to interrupt the emotional brain's automatic routing. You're inserting a pause. See what I did there? All right. Then, located in your body, not in your mind, in your body, where do you feel it physically? Chest tightness, your stomach, tension in your jaw or hands, heat? Get specific. You're not running from the wave, you're watching it. Then I want you to breathe, not as a distraction, actually as a physiological intervention. A slow exhale that's longer than your inhale activates the parasympathetic nervous system, your body's natural break. Try 6 counts in and 8 counts out. Repeat that like 3 times and you'll feel a change. And then you ride. You don't tell yourself you shouldn't be feeling this. You don't shame yourself for the craving. You observe it. This is intense, like right now. You have to say, it's not going to kill me. It will pass. Then just give it 5 minutes. Change rooms. Go outside. Call someone. Go about your normal life. And when it passes, and it will, you write it down. Craving at 11 p.m. Surfed it. Lasted 8 minutes. Passed. That record becomes evidence against the lie. You're building a new history one wave at a time. Another version of this that I love is the path plan. Go listen to episode 106, where I interviewed Dan Johnson about the path plan, where you pause, acknowledge, set a timer, and then give yourself a high five when that urge passes. I want to say something from kind of a pastoral place, and I can do that because I have a master's of divinity, not the candy, but of theology. So, you know, that makes me pastoral, I guess. And I mean like a C+ pastor based on the grading scale at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, but a pastor nonetheless. A lot of men in recovery believe that if they still have cravings, it means they haven't truly changed. They hear renewed mind and interpret it as cravings disappear. And when the cravings don't disappear, especially early in recovery, they read that as evidence that God hasn't shown up, that they're too far gone for this to work. Look, that's a lie. Jesus was tempted. Scripture doesn't say he briefly considered temptation and moved on. It says he was tempted in every way that we are. Temptation is not a sin. The craving is not the failure. Having the wave is not drowning. You are a man who is learning to surf. And this maps directly to the matrix. If you look at the trapped quadrant, where you're living in captivity, high awareness with low action. This is a man who understands his triggers, maybe even tracks them, but hasn't built the practical skills to interrupt them. He knows what happens. He doesn't know what to do when it does. Awareness without tools leads to shame spirals, not freedom. Now, the transformational quadrant is living in integrity. That's the high awareness and high action. This is where trigger knowledge meets practical skill. The man in the transformational quadrant knows his emotional landscape, has urge surfing in his toolkit, reaches out before the falls rather than after, and processes emotions through relationship instead of through a screen. This is not perfection, it's just integration. And look, here's the deal about the first 90 days of recovery. Not the version where everything gets better and clarity descends like a dove, but the actual version. Because when men don't know what's coming, they interpret the difficulty as evidence that recovery isn't working. And they quit right before the lift. When you stop using pornography, your brain enters a recalibration period. Some people call it withdrawal, and while it's not identical to substance withdrawal, it is real and it is hard. I'm going to rattle off some numbers here related to the timing of the first 90 days, but keep in mind, these are the first 90 days of recovery, not the first 90 days after being discovered. This matters. So if you're not doing the work, then you can't count the day. Your first 90 days may take 90 days or 90 months. That part is mostly up to you. Okay, so if you're doing recovery well, in the first 1 to 2 weeks, your brain is flooded with the absence of what it was expecting. You may feel flat, irritable, anxious, disconnected, sometimes all those things at once. Some men feel a surprising emotional numbness. Others feel the opposite, unexpected grief, unexpected anger, emotions surfacing that they haven't had words for in years. Sleep is often disrupted. Concentration drops. There's this low hum of anxiety that doesn't really have a clear source. What's happening neurologically is that your brain's reward system is recalibrating. The receptors that were downregulated are slowly reopening. That process is uncomfortable, and it's supposed to be. All right, weeks 3 through 6, I need to say this clearly because this is where men often fall apart. The initial motivation sometimes fades in those weeks 3 through 6. The relief of, I'm finally doing this, gives way to the grinding reality of sustained recovery. The neural pathways that were built over years, they don't disappear in 3 weeks. The brain still reaches for what it knows. And cravings can actually intensify in this window before they begin to diminish. If you're at day 22 and you feel worse than you did at day 3, that doesn't mean recovery isn't working. That may mean you're in the middle of the hardest part. You are in the furnace, and the furnace is doing its job. I love this song from my favorite band, Need to Breathe, and their song, Hard Love, on the album with the same title, released in 2016, that says, it's not enough to just feel the flame. You got to burn your whole self away. Okay, between 6 and 12 weeks, most men begin to experience what I'd call the lift. Sleep normalizes, the gray flatness of anhedonia starts to recede, ordinary pleasures begin to return, not all at once, but they return. A real meal, a real laugh, a real moment of connection with those closest to you, a voltage comes back. The prefrontal cortex, which has been suppressed by years of compulsive behavior, begins to come back online. Decision-making feels less reactive. You start to catch yourself before the trigger completes. You have a half-second pause where before you had nothing. That half-second is everything, too. That is the crack in the door where grace comes in. So by 90 days, the brain has not fully healed. Full neurological recalibration can take, 12 to 18 months. And men report, ongoing change for years, of course. But 90 days is meaningful because it represents the establishment of neural pathways. The old road still exists, but a new road is being paved. And something else begins to happen in that window that science can describe, but truly can't explain. It's this identity shift. Men who make it through the first 90 days don't just feel different. They see themselves differently. The story they tell about who they are starts to change. You move from, I'm an addict trying not to act out, to I'm a man being made new. That is 2 Corinthians 5:17. If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old is gone. The new is here. The science confirms what the scripture declares. The brain changes. The man changes. You aren't stuck. So, the first 90 days are not about arriving at the transformational quadrant. They're about discovering that it exists. That transformation is real. The matrix, it's a map. It's not this verdict. The men who make it through are not stronger than the men who don't. They're better informed. They're better supported. And they stayed in the furnace long enough for the fire to do its work. Let me wrap up with this. You are not a moral failure who happens to have a problem. You are a man with a wounded brain, a weary soul, and a God who specializes in exactly that combination. The neuroscience isn't the good news. The neuroscience just explains the battlefield. The good news is that the God who designed your brain also knows exactly what it takes to heal it. And he has not given up on you. I'm going to say that again. God has not given up on you. Remember, your homework from today, do the trigger audit, write down your last three falls, look for the pattern, then practice urge surfing once this week, even without a craving. Practice the breathing, the naming, the observation, so when that wave actually comes, you're not learning to swim for the first time. Oh, and if you want to go deeper on the transformational recovery matrix, understanding which quadrant you're actually operating in and what it takes to move towards transformation, that's exactly what the book is built around. Now for the shameless plug, go look in the show notes and you can find a link on where to buy the Transformational Recovery Matrix. Trading punches with the heart of dog. Hey, thanks for listening to the Purity Podcast, sponsored by Castamonia. If this episode helped you understand your struggle a little differently, don't just file that information away. Do something with it. Awareness matters, but transformation requires action. Talk to another man. Do the trigger audit. Practice the tools. And keep taking the next right step in your recovery. For more information about Castamonia and our Christ-centered recovery meetings, visit castamonia.org. That's CASTIMONIA.org. And be sure to check out the show notes for the resources mentioned in today's episode. You can also email us at puritypodcast@castamonia.org. I'm Chris Archinall, and as always, remember that as you travel this journey of recovery, you are not walking alone. But there's a reason that the road is long. It takes some time to make your courage strong. Hold on.